Hello and welcome to the Metagenics Institute. My name is Dr. Bianca Garrilli, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jennifer Ryan, a naturopathic physician, in the second of a two-part podcast on the topics of digestive health and hyperpermeability. Dr. Ryan is a principal investigator and adjunct faculty member at the National University of Natural Medicine. Her research projects have primarily focused on nutrition and dietary supplements that have digestive and cardiovascular health applications. Current projects involve botanicals, probiotics, prebiotics, and the gut microbiome. Dr. Ryan teaches in the Master of Science in Nutrition and Master of Science in Integrative Medicine research programs at NUNM, where she previously earned her MD and MS. Prior to her clinical training, Dr. Ryan was a basic science researcher at several universities and institutions. She earned her BS in biology from the University of New Hampshire and has co-authored publications in various medical journals. So welcome back, Jennifer. It's great to speak with you again.
Thanks for having me, Bianca.
Well, we had a great conversation last time in our first of the two podcasts, and I wanted to give our listeners a quick review of what we talked about originally in case they hadn't had the chance to listen to the first podcast, but I would highly recommend that you definitely go back to all of our listeners and listen to that first one as well. Now, in the first of the podcasts that we had, Dr. Ryan talked to us about digestive health and hyperpermeability, where she discussed in great detail the physiology of the digestive tract, including the trans and paracellular transport mechanisms, a lot about tight junctions and how they are both protective and what happens when things go wrong with their function. We also talked about some of the reasons which hyperpermeability might occur. And Dr. Ryan, you included and spoke about the pro-inflammatory mediators, the zonulin aspect, as well as MLCK. And then we wrapped up our first podcast with a discussion on various clinical testing approaches. So I'm really excited, and I'm sure our listeners are as well today, to continue our discussion on these topics by moving into now both the causation as well as some of the therapeutic applications for intestinal hyperpermeability. So I wanted to first see if we could talk a little bit about the link between the diagnosis and treatment from your perspective as a naturopathic physician.
Yes, thank you for asking. The causes of intestinal hyperpermeability are multifactorial. So, of course, it varies from patient to patient, and there is no one-size-fits-all treatment. And as clinicians, we need to take a detailed history to identify factors contributing to increased permeability. And of course, I know that you know this, Bianca, also a fellow naturopathic physician, but treating the root cause of illness is a basic tenet of naturopathic philosophy. So from that perspective, treatment recommendations are typically based on addressing root causes or risk factors that are contributing to excessive gut permeability. And of course, we do this while keeping all symptoms and all known diagnoses and disease processes in mind.
So that kind of takes us back, right, Jennifer, to us being, or all of us as functional medicine providers, really looking at the whole picture and looking at root causes. So in terms of intestinal hyperpermeability, what might be some of those root causes that we would be most interested in learning about and addressing for our patients?
Well, from my perspective, root causes of hyperpermeability are going to fall into three broad categories with lots of overlap. So diet, lifestyle, and gut flora.
Absolutely. So lifestyle and diet, all of these things are so important to our patients. So let's start with diet, if that's okay.
Yeah.
What are some of those dietary factors that would promote the intestinal hyperpermeability, and what would you suggest as treatment approaches?
Well, for those who listened to the last podcast, it's no surprise that we have to talk about gluten. So consumption of gluten leads to increased permeability of the gut lining, and this has been established even in healthy controls. And this happens in a matter of minutes after we've been exposed to gluten. As far as who needs to be on a gluten-free diet, there is overwhelming agreement that patients with celiac disease have to be on a lifelong gluten-free diet. This is the cornerstone of treatment for celiac disease, and gluten has to be removed from the diet in order to halt or minimize the autoimmune process. and some of our listeners may be aware of non-celiac gluten sensitivity. So more and more people who don't have celiac disease have been following a gluten-free diet. And the food industry has responded with more and more gluten-free products. And there are mixed opinions about why this is the case, especially if you've been reading material written for lay audiences. I've seen articles speculating about whether or not this is just a trend or if an increasing proportion of the population actually does have sensitivity to gluten without having celiac disease. But there are peer-reviewed publications showing that non-celiac gluten sensitivity is an emerging medical condition. So these are patients who've had celiac disease ruled out, and they've also had allergy to wheat or gluten ruled out. What they do demonstrate is an improvement in symptoms when they follow a gluten-free diet. So this is kind of a functional issue. Those symptoms that improve, they could be intestinal or extra-intestinal. And studies have shown that when you take people from this population and you expose their intestinal cells to gliadin, those cells exhibit higher permeability than the intestinal cells of a healthy control. As far as everyone else, some clinicians may advocate for just about everyone to be on a gluten-free diet. And so this is a message from some popular books on the connection between grains and the brain and wheat and other organ systems. Other clinicians may make that determination on a case-by-case basis. This could be guided by lab testing, which, as you mentioned, we talked about last time. And this could also be guided by implementing a gluten-free diet, at least on a temporary basis. And it's worth keeping in mind that a patient could have subclinical immune activation to gliadin. And anti-gliadin antibodies don't just react with gliadin. They've been shown to cross-react with human proteins throughout the body. The enterocytes are neurons and the thyroid. So when evaluating whether or not a patient's symptoms have improved on a gluten-free diet, it's really important to be thinking systemically.
I agree with you. There's practitioners who really go into everybody's going to be on a gluten-free diet, and then we find also that maybe they don't have a celiac disease picture, but they are sensitive to the gluten. And from right. what you're telling us here, that's a majority of people. It just seems to be the underlying physiology of what happens when we ingest this particular particle. So yeah. if we look at it, if a patient decided either A, they would go on a gluten-free diet or they wouldn't, what other things might we do, especially if, let's say, our patient is a little bit reluctant to put the whole gluten-free diet into practice? Are there other things we can add on to their therapeutic approach?
Yeah, there's a lot more we can do. So many patients are going to benefit from a diet that's low in refined carbohydrates, and I emphasize the word refined. So one thing that several well-researched therapeutic diets have in common is an emphasis on consuming vegetables and minimal processed foods. So some of the best examples are vegan or predominantly plant-based diets, as researched and recommended by physicians like Dean Ornish and Neil Barnard. But the Mediterranean diet and even the DASH diet also encourage the adding in of vegetables and the crowding out of refined carbs and simple sugars. Many of those diets, they're mostly aimed at preventing and treating our number one cause of death, of course, heart disease, but a diet that's low in refined and processed carbs and high in veggies doesn't just protect us from cardiovascular disease, diabetes, cancer, it also strengthens the integrity of our gut lining through a couple of mechanisms. So this is partly due to the high fiber content of veggies. Fibers, they act as prebiotics that support butyrate production. Butyrate, a short-chain fatty acid that has several beneficial functions, but most pertinent to this discussion is that butyrate decreases gut permeability. And it does so because it inhibits NF-kappa-B, which is a central regulator of inflammation. When NF-kappa-B is activated, higher levels of pro-inflammatory cytokines are produced, and as we discussed last time, pro-inflammatory cytokines increase permeability. So by supporting butyrate production with a high-fiber diet, we reduce gut permeability. And another function of butyrate is that it decreases pH, which is what we want in the colon. Lower pH is protective against potentially harmful and permeability-promoting gut flora. And another thing I have to emphasize is that simple sugars increase gut permeability. And the mechanism for this is a basic gut physiology concept. When glucose, for example, is absorbed by the enterocytes, it goes through a sodium glucose cotransporter. The glucose is moved through the cell and quickly into the circulation. So this is normal transcellular absorption. But as we discussed in the last podcast, the transcellular route upregulates the paracellular route. And that's exactly what happens when we eat high amounts of simple sugars. So normal physiology, it didn't become a problem for humans until we began consuming completely unnatural amounts of refined sugars. So current estimates are that the average American now eats about 150 pounds of sugar a year. We know this contributes to our diabetes epidemic, but it's also contributing to intestinal hyperpermeability, which, as we discussed last time, is connected to a plethora of chronic diseases. And one last point is that when diets are rich in veggies and low in refined carbohydrates, that's one approach that helps us to avoid one of the pitfalls of going on a gluten-free diet. The pitfall I'm referring to is when a patient is eating a not-so-great diet, they get the recommendation to eat a gluten-free diet, or they've decided on their own to go on a gluten-free diet, and then they simply replace all of the gluten-containing foods with gluten-free versions of those same foods. So bread, pizza, cake, you name it, you can find a gluten-free version even in mainstream supermarkets. Major problem, though, is that those items are still high in refined carbohydrates, they're heavily processed, and they're often higher in salt and sugar to compensate for textural and flavor differences. But as I've just described, those carbs and sugars promote gut hyperpermeability.
Well, I am so glad you mentioned that, because I think that's such a huge area where we can really support our patients in that there's a gluten-free diet and there's a gluten-free diet, right? There's one that's healthy for you and there's one that is actually could be very detrimental.
And just because something's gluten-free doesn't mean we should be eating it.
It seems really obvious, but yet it's not obvious, right? Because when we do substitute something, we can either substitute it for a helpful food or we can substitute for a detrimental or non-helpful food. And to your fact here of 150 pounds of sugar a year, that's pretty darn high. And I would tend to agree that we have to really help our patients understand if we are going to go on a gluten-free diet, what that actually looks like. And so you're pointing out that the higher fiber, the higher vegetables, the low processed carbs is really the way to go and looking at that Mediterranean diet. And then we also talk a lot about the anti-inflammatory diets. Can you give us a little more information on how we can focus in on those anti-inflammatory diets?
Yes. The typical anti-inflammatory diet has overlap with dietary approach mentioned, as you've just mentioned. They're typically gluten and wheat-free, high in veggies, and they include some fruit, and they're void of refined carbohydrates and processed foods. They also emphasize the avoidance of any fried foods and fat from certain sources to help minimize the excessive consumption of trans fats and omega-6 fatty acids that are promoting systemic inflammation by driving up prostaglandin, leukotriene, thromboxane production. And many naturopathic physicians and functional medicine doctors, they recommend this type of approach. I've written books on this matter. A very popular method right now that probably most listeners have heard of involves eating a whole anti-inflammatory diet for 30 days at least. So anti-inflammatory diets, they reduce permeability by eliminating gluten, refined sugars, and they also support butyrate production via high fiber consumption.
So now we've got our patients on this awesome diet, right? Because that's what we love doing is really tweaking diets and getting them to be personalized and individualized for the needs of each of our patients. But I'm guessing there's a lot more we can do even beyond diet. And is that something you can speak to as well, Jen?
Yeah, so lifestyle factors, we should talk about those as well. And well, let's start with alcohol, which some people may consider to be part of their diet. Of course, we know that excessive alcohol consumption is a risk factor for many diseases, and much of that has to do with issues like systemic inflammation and blood sugar abnormalities. But within the GI tract, alcohol increases intestinal permeability. And the reason this happens is that alcohol contributes to gut dysbiosis, which is a disruption in the homeostasis of the intestinal flora. This dysbiosis is associated with endotoxemia, which is the presence of increased bacterial endotoxin in the blood. And we've seen this in studies that have compared the gut flora and blood levels of endotoxins in individuals with alcoholism compared to healthy controls. So in general, the term endotoxin is synonymous with bacterial LPS. So not only is the absorption of LPS into the circulation powerfully pro-inflammatory, LPS increases the permeability of our tight junctions. And this happens because LPS stimulates pro-inflammatory cytokine production. We talked about this last time. The pro-inflammatory cytokines promote permeability by increasing the expression of a signaling molecule, MLCK, that tells our tight junctions to open up. As far as a recommendation, some clinicians may approve of a small amount of regular alcohol consumption, especially since it has historically been considered mildly cardioprotective. But in general, if the goal is to improve the barrier of the GI tract, alcohol consumption should be minimal, if at all. And another important lifestyle factor is stress. So that, too, increases gut permeability. And as I discussed this, Bianca, you'll notice some recurring themes. Just like alcohol, stress increases permeability by promoting dysbiosis. It also involves higher levels of LPS getting into the circulation, causing local and systemic inflammation and dysfunction in our tight junctions. And especially with chronic stress, we can end up in a cycle where the stress is allowing more LPS to be absorbed paracellularly. The LPS is triggering increases in cytokines, this upregulates those signals, causing the tight junctions to open up chronically, which is allowing more LPS in. So it's this pathologic positive feedback loop. Now, of course, many conditions are going to improve when we reduce stress, and there are a number of well-researched techniques that can be suggested. But what's feasible for each patient is really going to vary quite a bit based on age, life stage, what's going on with their career and their family obligations. So again, this goes back to a detailed history and a discussion with your patient about what's going to be possible for them. Some good advice, though, for all patients and healthcare providers, too, is to have healthy habits when we're eating, regardless of what dietary pattern we're following. So we shouldn't be standing, we shouldn't be walking or driving a car when we're eating. And we shouldn't be eating at our desks while we work either. So one of many reasons to be present and relaxed when we're eating is that it encourages healthy barrier function rather than excessive permeability.
But yeah, that's a big one, Jen. I agree with you. This stress piece is so ubiquitous in our lives these days. And as I sit here and speak to you and hear you tell me about not eating at my desk, I see my breakfast plate over there in the corner where I had it earlier this morning, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it sounds like this lifestyle piece is really important. And it's not just about telling our patients what to do. It's actually helping them to implement. So talking to them about how to implement some of these stress modifications, reduction, minimalization of the alcohol use. And what other pieces can we talk to them about in terms of the root causes of gut hyperpermeability to help educate them on in terms of their everyday life and long-term prevention?
Well, if we, you know, continue focusing on gut flora, there are things that we can do as far as prevention, but I did want to touch on a few factors that we have less control over. So preterm infants born by cesarean, they're more likely to have dysbiosis. For the little ones, formula feeding increases intestinal permeability. Regardless of age, this is where we have a little more control, antibiotic exposures can lead to dysbiosis. So, of course, we can't go back in time and change birth method or antibiotics that have already been given. We can encourage and support breastfeeding if we're working with infants and their families. Regardless of age, we need to avoid the overuse and the inappropriate use of antibiotics. We can optimize diet, use prebiotics and probiotics to support healthy gut flora. And I also wanted to mention NSAIDs because they really need to be used judiciously. Of course, with long-term use, we know that they can cause enteropathy, but studies have shown that they increase permeability in as little as 24 hours.
Wow, Jen, so you've given us a lot to think about in terms of root causes of this gut permeability. Now, these are things that we just talked about where we sometimes have control over from a lifestyle perspective, but if we shift approaches now and think of it from a supplementation and nutraceutical approach, can you give us some more information? We hear a lot about probiotics and other supplements that can be used to benefit patients with intestinal hyperpermeability. Do you have some top supplements or top items that you recommend or consider useful in this area?
Yeah, so I've got a handful of specific recommendations that can be made based on evidence, peer-reviewed, published clinical evidence. So the first is Lactobacillus salivarius UCC118. This is a strain that's been shown to protect against experimentally induced tight junction disassembly in human intestinal cells. This strain, UCC118, it also promotes healthy microbial balance by producing bacteriocins. They inhibit the growth of pathogens and thereby reduce dysbiosis. Another probiotic is Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG, or L. rhamnosus GG. This is the most well-studied probiotic in preclinical studies and in human subjects. So there's so much information on Lactobacillus rhamnosus GG. Just to mention a couple of things, it has demonstrated immunomodulating benefits clinically, like decreasing the contraction of respiratory and GI infections. But in vitro, L. rhamnosus GG has been shown to reduce permeability and enhance tight junction formation. And just like UCC118, L. rhamnosus GG also promotes healthy gut flora. It increases species diversity and inhibits pathogens. And part of how it interferes with pathogens is that it hinders their ability to form biofilms, which I find really fascinating. So not only does L. rhamnosus GG reduce intestinal permeability, it helps to reduce dysbiosis and has these added immunomodulatory benefits that I mentioned. And I already mentioned veggies as part of a healthy diet, as a source of prebiotics to support butyrate production, but there is a prebiotic that I know of that can be given to support butyrate production. So this unique prebiotic source that clinicians may or may not have heard of is human milk oligosaccharides, also called HMOs. So these are prebiotics that are abundant in human milk. They're considered a key bifidogenic factor, and they promote the growth of bifidobacteria. They're considered a key reason why breastfed infants have more bifidobacteria than formula-fed infants. One particular HMO, 2' fucosyl lactose, also called 2FL, it's been shown to support butyrate production clinically. Again, butyrate decreases gut permeability and has many other functions. 2FL also hinders the ability of pathogenic microbes and their toxins to adhere to the GI epithelium. And this is part of why breast milk is so protective against NEC in infants. I know of one product on the market for adults that contains 2FL. I've heard that there are more to come. Another supplement is glutamine. This is considered a conditionally essential amino acid. It has several important roles for our enterocytes, but what's most pertinent here is that glutamine helps regulate intestinal barrier function. When our enterocytes are deprived of glutamine, our tight junction proteins are downregulated and permeability is increased. On the other hand, glutamine has been shown to restore normal barrier function. And a couple of botanicals that can be used. I mentioned earlier that butyrate decreases gut permeability by increasing F-kappa-B. And when NF-kappa-B is reduced, fewer pro-inflammatory cytokines are produced. Well, there are a few botanicals that reduce NF-kappa-B: ginger, curcumin, xanthohumol, and Boswellia serrata. So curcumin and xanthohumol, they also, have specifically been shown to reduce cytokines. We know that TNF-alpha promotes permeability. So curcumin has been shown to decrease serum levels of TNF-alpha. Xanthohumol has been shown to decrease the production of TNF-alpha by white blood cells. And also ginger and Boswellia extracts, they've been shown to prevent experimentally induced hyperpermeability, specifically in human intestinal cells. So not only can these botanical ingredients support a healthy inflammatory response, they can also support the integrity of the gut lining.
This is a great list, Jen, and I really appreciate it. You've given us a lot to think about, so I just want to take a quick moment and summarize the information that you gave to us today. We started out the podcast and we followed up from the initial podcast on some of the root causes of intestinal hyperpermeability. And we talked about lifestyle being a big component, dysbiosis or the gut flora, and again, the lifestyle diet components. And then you went on and you really focused in on each of these areas for us and helping us to understand more about the importance of an anti-inflammatory diet that might piggyback on that Mediterranean approach where we've got the high fiber, low processed carbohydrates, all of these helping to support that butyrate production and supporting the tight junction function itself. And then we talked a little bit about the potential detriments of stress, which we all probably feel on a very frequent basis, and some of the things that we might be able to do to modulate that, as well as the consumption of alcohol and how that can promote those pro-inflammatory cytokines. And then you gave us this really nice summary at the end here where we can understand what do we do with it, right? We have this information. We took a great history from our patients, but now how do we really approach this to support them in the therapeutic process? And so we've got these great lifestyle, again, approaches, but also these supplements and nutraceuticals. You talked to us about the probiotics, the different specific strains that would be appropriate, as well as the HMOs and the 2'-FL, the glutamine, and a host of others. It's just been a great podcast in speaking with you, Jen, and learning about this and really going into the details. So I really appreciate you being on with us and hope to learn more from you in the near future.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, there's really so much that we can do.
Thank you, Jen.